Supported Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series starting Saturday, September 17th with singer-songwriter Tim Grimm. Folk Music Series of 9 Saturday concerts starts September 17th and continues through May of 2023 at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele. Season tickets are now available. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.
She's such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Joshua.
Betu washtelo, chantea washte na pechis up yellow, le unkipi ki he washtelo. Greetings and good day, and welcome, you relatives. I give you hands with a heart of good feelings. It's good for all of us to be here. And since 1992, this is First Voices Radio and Teokas and Ghost Tour sending you greetings and strength from the highlands of the Esopus, or what Americans and Dutch call the Catskill Mountains. Regardless, it is the highlands of the Esopus in the lands of the Munsee-speaking Lenape. First Voices Radio is produced by Liz Hill. Our technical engineer is the Malcolm Byrne. And we broadcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprouts, Spotify, as well as firstvoicesindigenousradio.org for archive downloading and listening. Our guest, Jennifer Robin of the Choctaw Nation, is the owner of Ofini Productions. Jennifer is a multi-award-winning producer and radio host and television segment producer. Her weekly two-hour live program, Resilience Radio, presents Native American authors, artists, musicians, storytellers, and activists, and showcases contemporary Native music. She was a broadcaster for Spirit Radio, Standing Rock's official station. She's a member of the Native American Journalists Association. And we're talking to Jennifer about the ongoing fires in California. And welcome you, Jennifer Robin of the Choctaw Nation. Thank you for joining us. And you're experiencing climate emergency, in other words, ecological collapse. But we can get all the science we want, but when it comes down to personal experience, you have a different story. Can you tell us about what just happened in California? And I know that you've been in that area of Mariposa County and near the Oak Fire, I think it is. And I know you came very close, smell the smoke, so to speak. And let's begin with that, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us here on First Voices.
I ran into the fire. So on the 22nd in the late afternoon, I get a text from our Mariposa County Sheriff's alerts that there is a fire started not too far from me, the next little town a few miles up the road. I, being a California resident, I kind of went, and went back to business. By that evening, the fire had exploded and evacuation orders were expanded, and my main highway off of 140 was closed. So I attended a town hall meeting just to figure out what is going on, because here in Mariposa, when you say you live in town, there's only, you know, let's say 30 houses actually in the little town. Everybody else lives in this major vein of Triangle Road and up in the Ponderosa Basin. So when I saw the evacuation map and the fire footprint through the heart of our residential community, I kind of lost my mind. So after the town hall, there was a fire lit under my hiney, and I called KVMR. Excuse me. I called KVMR and said, I need a press pass because this is intense. So the next morning with my press pass, I interviewed the fire chief on just kind of where things are at and what's going on. And my main goal with the press pass, having access to all these areas, was to check on tribal member residences. So I pulled over, I talked to the sheriff. I said, how far is safe to go? He said, you have a press pass. Do what you want. We're not coming for you. I said, fair enough. One of my first stops was off of Carlton Road. Yosemite Bear Tours was started by Paul Vasquez, and people may remember him from the Double Rainbow video about a decade or so ago. And I went up to my friend's property, Kevin and Irene Vasquez Spock, and everything was gone. Teokas, and I've never seen anything like this. It was decimated. There was nothing. Decimated. They had three structures on the property, a fifth wheeler, an old 75 single wide, and a yurt. And there was no evidence of anything there. So a wayward cousin of wayward granddaughter Julia Parker, Tashina Parker, was with me, and we just continued up to Jerseydale into the heart of the fire to check on other residences. And when we got to Ursula Jones, the granddaughter of world-renowned basket maker Julia Parker, I kind of lost my mind. There was charcoal, charred chunks of debris from the sky on their terrible old wooden stairs. And Tashina opened the door and it was unlocked. And there we saw a Smithsonian showcase of baskets that are over 200 years old. And at that point, I was ready to throw everything in my car, but I was advised, hey, let's get a hold of Ursula, the homeowner, and see what we can do. So I get back to my house where I have cell service, and Tashina heads off to go find better internet. And it's eating away at me, these baskets, this history, the shared American history was eating away at me. So I called my fire chief friend back and explained, I had a whole speech ready, and I explained, hey, in the heart of the fire off Jerseydale Road, there's a fleet of baskets. What can we do? 25 minutes later, there was a sheriff escort waiting for us at the fairgrounds to take us up back in. I could have just gone back with her and my press pass, but I didn't want to endanger ourselves, lose the privilege of press pass, even though I'm taking a caravan. And after all the conversations about these interagency relationships, it was really important for me to do this in the right way. So we drove back up to Jerseydale to Best Road. And I can text you a photo of how close the fire came to these things. But we filled my trunk and her trunk with everything from cradle boards to cooking baskets to seed baskets to even just prepared basket making materials, some redbud, and made it back to my house to rearrange everything and get these invaluable, irreplaceable objects returned to Julia Parker, who is safe on the east side. So through all of this, I know everybody lost a lot. Many people lost everything, but going, asking for help from the authorities was not in my character, but I did it. And being able to retrieve these items in a safe way, in a respectable way, is one of the proudest moments of my little life here.
What, this is Central California, I'm thinking Eastern Central California, but the tribes or the people that live in that area, who are they? I mean, you're listening to, people are listening to this history, this knowledge that's being kept, and where did you put the baskets after all, Jennifer?
Well, we are in Mariposa, the town of Mariposa in Mariposa County, and we are right outside of Yosemite National Park. Yosemite National Park has seven associated tribes that through time in memoriam have come into the valley, migrated for summers, and then would head down to lower elevations in the winters. So I am sitting with the Southern Sierra Miwok here in Mariposa County, in the town of Mariposa. And the amount of information exchanged over thousands of years on techniques and basket making materials and processing acorns and the trade of food. We would trade a lot of things for obsidian because we had no obsidian on this side. So trading grasses that we have access to with Bishop tribe, for example, they can't grow certain things. We don't have obsidian. So there's these long-standing trade routes that are integral to the survival of these seven associated tribes in the area. So these baskets, these invaluable baskets, are part of a chunk of southern, of the Sierra Nevada mountain range in California history and shared history. So I can't explain in any, I have no words for it, holding these baskets, retrieving these baskets, and you feel the ancientness. They were here before me and they're gonna be here long after me. And collecting some of the redbud that was prepared, it takes 2 years to prepare some of these basket materials. So even retrieving the raw materials and acknowledging how and what those are gonna become and who weaves them and who's taught to weave them. So There's seven associated tribes with the very popular, well-known Yosemite Valley. And being in Mariposa on the southern Sierra Miwok end, there is a shared cultural exchange for thousands and thousands and thousands of years with these seven associated tribes. For example, in Bishop territory, they had a ton of obsidian, but no grasses that grew for basketry. So there was trade routes established beginning of time to exchange these things. So when you're looking at a basket, to me, it's not just an isolated story or an isolated tribe's items or an isolated pocket in American history. This is shared history. This is shared tribal history. This is the history of the Sierra Nevada mountains, which were the first to be decimated by the gold rush. So there was very little intention in California to set up any reservation systems, because America just finished the Mexican-American War, dealing with Spanish reclaiming land. So with all the resources, and especially gold in California, it was paid genocide. The government paid militias to come down, capture and kill natives. You were paid to enslave children. So in my mind, every single grass, every single basket, every single descendant of these tribes is a miracle, is a California Holocaust survivor. So holding these things you feel the resilience, you feel the ancientness, you feel all of these incredible energies coming from just a basket.
That's a very good explanation about that. Let's talk about the traditional knowledge that people say is lost, but you just talked about it still being there, very alive. Even how to care for the forest, the trees, the mountains, and water. And I know you said the knowledge is in the basket and basically codified within that. So we, as the human race, is experiencing anthropogenic climate crisis. And this is where I think, Jennifer, a lot of that knowledge you talked about should be coming in from Native people, of how not just to prevent forest fires, but what led up to the symptoms that we're experiencing now. Because it seems if we took care of the source, there would not be these symptoms of fire, because we're thinking only about humans. Well, I do know that a lot of knowledgeable language-speaking Natives think of all life, not just the human factor here.
Well, I guess to me, the basket symbolizes water, because the grasses grow from water. They symbolize caretaking with fire, because a lot of these grasses grow better after control burns. And the tribes knew this. But here where we are, we're dealing with United States Forestry Service, which is a government agency. We're dealing with CAL FIRE, which is a state agency. So when you're working with these agencies, things are slow to change. And also, indigenous knowledge is still looked at as non-scientific because it wasn't learned in their textbooks at fire school or whatever. But speaking to the fire chief, who had 30 years of experience, he has never seen fire patterns the way that they experienced them. Usually they have some kind of idea of how fire will move based on the topography, based on wind. They usually have some kind of heads up guesstimate on how to position themselves. And the dry heat, the dry ground, the lack of care for the land in the area, meaning maintenance and fire prevention measures on private properties, it exploded into an quickly unmanageable vortex. And it wasn't just fire, it was heat. These concentrated amounts of heat. I've seen melted pools of metal. I mean, this is just beyond grasses burning. This is creating a vortex of decimating heat levels through all these pockets up here in Mariposa County.
It's very interesting because I'm hearing indigenous people's way of life and the Miwok in that area. But really the terminology that's missing from that is you intended that, well, you did say it and alluded to this language, is that there are spirits in that forest. There needed to be tended to. And to me, that because you live there, it's coming through. So without misunderstanding the energy of where we are, and I think part of that is restoration, but not the Western style restoration. You know what I mean, Jen? Is that what's more needed is the original thinking, the original patterns laid down to really look at, you can control the burning through indigenous methods. But that all starts with ceremony, does it not?
It absolutely does. Our giant sequoias that were on fire with the Washburn fire that started a little bit before this one, these sequoias are 3,000 years old, and these seeds don't germinate unless they're exposed to fire, right? Mm-hmm. So in ceremony is where we remove ourselves from this human body and start to make an attempt to understand and listen to that natural world. And if you are in a place like Yosemite, or if you are in a place of a forest and you don't feel those spirits, if you don't feel that energy, if you can't hear the little sweet messages and all the bird chirping and all the gossip that the crows bring, then you need to get yourself back into ceremony. Right. Because they're from the insects, from beneath the ground, this starts, to the top of the trees, this starts. And when you are an indigenous community living within the natural environment, burning wasn't just for you and your safety. Burning was putting nutrients back in the soil. Burning was clearing some of the weeds away so you get more grasses that grow. Burning made the manzanita stronger. Burning brought back the sequoia trees. So when we look at control burns, it seems to be for us and our safety. But from a tribal indigenous perspective, burning safely is for all the creatures.
And a Western view would say that it's bad. And because humans can't play there anymore, they can't hike their trails and, you know, their little campfires and take their little marshmallows to burn in the fire. But it's not bad. I'm hearing it's not bad for Native people to do these, replenish with this natural cycle of the forest anyway. So natural resource management, quote unquote, these terms that are coming up for really saying, well, why are we trying to manage nature when it already knows what it's doing in the first place?
Well, you say managing resources. Whose resources are you talking about managing? That's number one. You know, are you managing resources for campgrounds? Are you managing resources for local indigenous people to have access to the medicines and to all the things that are deeply embedded and woven not into their baskets, but into their culture and who they are?
Is there such thing as a fire expert? I really don't get that. Are there fire experts that, you know, you can learn about in textbooks and go to climate school and all of a sudden you have the answer? Because the language that we're speaking, the cultures that we have, are ways of seeing this world differently because we're involved in it. We're not using reality. We're living the reality of, quote unquote, the ecosystem. I'm hearing through this all is that we're still adapting to the earth rather than the Western style of adapting earth to our needs.
Bingo. And we're not allowed to really have experts. Okay. We have things like liaisons. Okay. We are not given titles on the same par as the fire chief, as county sheriff, as, you know, we get little titles like liaisons, these little bridges. One of the tribal members, Irene Vasquez, that lost her home, actually has a degree in ecology and has been working with fire management in the park. She was actually taken off the Washburn fire and sent home to try to protect her home and evacuate. So even within her GoFundMe, while she does work for Yosemite Conservancy and was helping the park, she wasn't even allowed to put Yosemite in her GoFundMe because Yosemite got upset that the only reason you receive funds was because the word Yosemite. So here we have somebody dedicated to the land, master's degree educated, hardworking for years, dedicated to all of mankind, not just tribal, but keeping the park clear and beautiful for the tourists, is still diminished, dismissed, and knocked out of even using the word of her homeland.
It's incredible. So go ahead.
No, you. I'm now I'm mad. So yes, you go ahead.
Yeah, that's the idea here, to get everybody riled up. You know, like, this is just not in California, it's everywhere. And the same plan is applied to Turtle Island, if not the world. But I'm talking with Jennifer Robin, who's host of Resilience Radio, and you can hear that. And I think part of that is learning live radio is very human as it can get, with natives living within the land that you are also living with. So, but it's just, again, this honor of having you and this Resilience Radio out on the West Coast. It feels like you're the gate, I wouldn't say gatekeeper, but you're a guardian of the voice out there, and it speaks through the forest, through the people. So I just want to honor you for that, Jennifer.
I get all blushed up, and it is an honor to talk to you, because there are very few of us that do this every week. There are very few of us that have long-standing careers in indigenous radio, and radio is just kind of a dying art on its own. So I feel like you and I are like one of the last five on a battlefield, you know. But that's I'm proud to be in this with you.
Oh, that's so good. You know, you did some field work up in Cannonball during a Standing Rock protest with that Spirit Radio with Govinda. You were there, but you were also in this fire too. It seemed like, to me, it's the same kind of urgent energy going on, because yes, we can define it and give it terms and measure the disaster that's happening to the land, especially when you're not living on it. We'll do GPS maps. We'll do, you know, data information as to how much is going to be lost in millions and billions. But yet, there is no wisdom to all this information and technology unless you're experiencing it. And I think that's what I'm hearing. You say I haven't been on the air for all these, you know, maybe 100 years, but yet it feels like the earth is still new, still viable, and she's adjusting. She's moving so fast. We can't keep up with her, Jennifer. She's so intelligent.
We're not supposed to.
That's right. And yet we want to, with our science, you know, Western science, we'll explain, yet we're missing. It's like a generation gap. But I begin to understand that, what happened to, where's that gap? That's the gap we have with nature. There is a gap we don't understand anymore. And I think that is coming through now by you, places like you showed up in Standing Rock. People need to hear. And I want to beg the difference. I think radio is not dying. I think it's under the charred forest floor. You know, it's ready.
Well, Standing Rock, Cannonball, and working with Govinda, that became more important to me because the news media was just blatantly lying.
Right.
I had a hotel room because of all my equipment and temperature and charging and things like that. So I would experience thousands and thousands and thousands of people in a community of all races, indigenous or not. And I would go back, and the news media at that time would say hundreds are gathered. Hundreds of Native Americans are gathered. No, honey, there's thousands of people gathered. The next day, just lie. I mean, the blatant lies that corporate media put out shocked me, which lit something inside me to just tell the truth, to show the truth.
And that's what's needed now, especially with the fires. It's the same. Well, those fires, we don't hear anything about the fires here. Really don't. But I was coming to the apartment here, and I got outside, I start smelling smoke. So it's apropos to, I'm interviewing Jennifer Robin out there in California, and I smell smoke because there's probably fires that we're not aware of, let alone indigenous peoples there knowing already how to take care and and let the fires manage us, because we know where to go within the land. Now we just plan, you know, blueprints of, you know, here we're going to build a city and there a town, and, you know, without ever understanding the land and the contours that are within our bodies as indigenous folks. So, you know, I really want to, you know, hold you up out there and talk about Jennifer Robin Moore and Resilience Radio, because that's what's going to take. Yeah, really.
Well, you know, and even too, there's these little poofs of, oh, indigenous burning. Oh, let's learn about this. Yeah. But then when the indigenous people get together to do cleanup burns and to do controlled burns in their way on their lands, permit, get this guy, call this guy, permit. And by the time all these permits are done, it's raining again and we've lost another summer. Quite maddening when people, it feels like they're fake caring in a way. And maybe that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's probably not true, but it feels dismissive and it feels bottom of the barrel. So to have the sheriff's department and the fire department so quickly jump into action to help with at least these baskets, with at least this tiny pocket that I had mm-hmm. a minuscule control over, makes me think there's progress, right? Makes me feel a little bit better about the community I'm in. But it's moving forward now as we get to the end of the summer and as we start preparing for next summer. How much of that indigenous knowledge will CAL FIRE and the USGS absorb?
Well, Jennifer, we have to go. I thank you for
being
here.
We always have to go.
I know. Isn't that nuts? It's like, okay, time's up. Time's up. Well, we just need to talk more.
We just need to talk more off air, right? Like, get it out and then do an interview.
We're gentrifying information, our knowledge, and gentrifying it so that they can understand us in a language that just is so restricted, it will never understand where we're coming from. And I think that's what their conscience tells them, because they can't deal with consciousness. You see where I'm going with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I appreciate you. Because you better articulate these experiences and these situations than I ever could, right? You bring it to the consciousness level, the bigger picture level, the human level, whereas I'm just sitting here kicking things and grunting because I don't have the words to articulate my feelings towards some of these situations and agencies. So I appreciate you for helping me get this out my body. Well, and as we celebrate triumphs as well, I'm going to fill you in on, you know, it's not all just tragedy and hardship and we're natives and the government's mean. You know, there's so much beauty and resilience and comeback stories that deserve some airtime.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to our future conversations.
Thanks, Jennifer. Take care of yourself.
All right. I feel like saying, Chihulili, I love you. All right.
And welcome back to First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse, and this is Soja from the album Peace in a Time of War. This is Revolution. George Gonatia was born and raised at the Mohawk Territory of Akwesasne, and he attended school on and near the reservation before enrolling at Syracuse University and then the Antioch School of Law. Doug was a co-founder of the Native American Journalists Association before serving the Mohawk Nation as editor of the journals Akwesasne Notes and Indian Time. He worked with the late Vine Deloria Jr. on the traditional knowledge conferences before joining the board of trustees for the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. And Doug is vice president of the Hiawatha Institute for Indigenous Knowledge, a nonprofit higher learning facility that is based on Iroquois principles. He resides on Oneida Iroquois territory. And I want to talk to you, Doug, about that. You were one of the 22 Native people asked to meet with him privately, but you turned it down. You turned a photo op down with the Pope, and you declined it. In a good way that people understood why you did. I know previously, a few months ago, we talked about the what an apology really means. Tell us why you were even selected as one of the 22 Native people to meet with the Pope.
Yeah, well, our Iroquois people, Haudenosaunee people, or Mohawk people have always been rather demonstrative and forceful and outspoken in our defense of our Indigenous heritage and collectively addressing issues that are of deep common concern to all Native people. And one of the things that, of course, we share in common with our kinfolk across the continent was displacement in the forcible taking of literally tens of thousands of Native people, Native children, and placing them into these residential boarding schools in a deliberate attempt to eradicate their heritage. Well, over the past couple of years, we've taken the lead in locating the possible burial sites for the children, identifying their physical remains, and then initiating a very aggressive repatriation initiative. Along those lines, what we've decided to do is we made sure that the Mohawk Residential School, where I was assigned when I was 11 years old, was a crime scene, and that afforded us additional protection and gave us access to forensic investigators, crime scene investigators, police, and all the apparatus that comes with that. And now we're using contemporary technologies to locate burial sites. And it's the same technology that the Ukrainian government is using to locate mass burials of citizens and who were shot or executed or died at the hands of the Russians. And then in an attempt to obscure those graves, well, the same thing happened at residential schools. There was a deliberate attempt to obscure where the children are buried. So what we're doing is we're establishing historical policies and procedures to do that. But it makes a lot of people uncomfortable because we have said repeatedly, the people at Oswegan Six Nations and our Mohawk people, that we will not accept any apology from any entity, whether it's the papacy or the federal government or individuals, unless there's an acknowledgement that crimes were committed against children, and children were suffered up to the point of their death, either by malnutrition, sickness, or physical abuse, in that people need to take absolute responsibility for this. That was always our position, and that once that was done, then you could discuss truth and then reconciliation based upon our terms as survivors. Now, up to this point, we were not, as Iroquois people, involved in the formation of those government policies, and we're changing that. So our theme is that nothing for us without us. And that makes, again, a lot of Native people outside of the Confederacy very uncomfortable because we don't believe in forgiveness unless there's something that makes us whole again, that restores our good spirits and things. That's a position we took, and I think that's why people were reluctant to have us speak to the Pope. But I made a bit of a fuss, and I said we at least had to have the opportunity to tell the Pope why we rejected his apology. As a kind of a concession, they agreed that I would be one of the 22 that would meet privately with the Pope in Quebec City, and then I would have my opportunity to bring up these issues. Well, I learned on Friday morning that last week, when before the meeting, that we were only going to be given 1 minute to summarize all of this, and that was simply impossible. There was no way we could affect change that we thought was necessary within the papacy for 1 minute. And so I said, I can't do this. It's a disservice to the Mohawk children who are victims. It's a disservice to our community. And I could not accept a photo opportunity with the Pope based on those conditions. So I turned them down. I said, no, can't do it.
Talk about based on those conditions where you rejected an apology without justice. Of course, it's their time. They're dictating to you how much of 500 years could be put into 1 minute. That's impossible, of course. Also, you said something about establishing this historical protocol, this mourning that we have been doing since then. But you also said maybe an endorsement of absolution without admission of guilt.
In canonical law, dating back to the times of the Crusades, the church would grant absolution to the those people who went on those crusades and were involved in extreme acts of violence, outright murder and destruction of the homes of indigenous people in that area. And before they would even commit a crime, he would say, you're already absolved. Don't worry about it. You have a free hand in that there can be no criminal act brought upon you once you've been granted this dispensation by the Roman Catholic Church. Well, the same thing here is that if we engage in the acceptance of an apology without acknowledgement of guilt, then the church will see that as absolution and that they can evade their lawful duties and obligations towards us. They can continue to prevent us from seeing the records that's necessary for us to answer the basic question of how many kids were stolen and what happened to them. The church has those records, and it involves hundreds and hundreds of Iroquois Mohawk children. up to this point are unaccounted for. And that's what we saw happening when he went out west to visit with the people out there. And they were talking, you know, some of those native leaders about this was an act of absolute forgiveness. And that's simply incorrect. We can't forgive without restoration. And that's why we took that hardline position. And I would have stood in front of the Pope and said, we acknowledge your words, however, we as Haudenosaunee people, as Mohawk people, reject them unless there's a viable commitment to secure justice for the victims of the church. And it wasn't just one individual. This was institutionalized. And people should remember that he was speaking from a script whenever he did these presentations in Alberta and Nunavut and Quebec City. It was all scripted. But when he got on the plane to go back to Rome, in answer to some questions, he did acknowledge that what happened to Native people was genocide, but qualified. The church, he did not acknowledge that the church was involved in genocide. And so once again, a little bit of evasiveness. And then when it comes to the doctrine of discovery, which is, you got to understand that to understand the whole boarding school system, because what it did, it gave them a legal basis to take the kids, because they were under God's directive, commanded to convert us to a Catholic Christian way of thinking. And we would have asked him to revise that, to rescind that. And then once that was done formally, then it would revolutionize the whole American Indian law, whether it's treaty law or territorial rights or jurisdiction or sovereignty. All of that will change dramatically when the Pope says the doctrine of discovery is formally rescinded. Then the Canadian American government has to find another way to deal with us, and they have to withdraw their band and tribal council system. So it gives us an opportunity to restore a traditional governance.
Doug George, also, you know, you talk about restoration and maybe reparation and all that stuff. What would that look like if they actually did rescind the papal bull's doctrine of discovery? They seem to be still in the performance mode right now, as I would say, with the evasiveness and also the denial language they're using. But what would happen if something just, you know, they said, okay, well, let's get it over with. Let's rescind this doctrine. Sure. What would happen? Yeah. Give us thoughts.
Well, here on Akwesasne, because it's the most complex, jurisdictional, confused area in North America, because as most people know, our community lies astride the border. And we have three existing councils, two of which are colonial. And then we have all these various policing agencies watching over us, everything from the FBI to the Border Patrol and the Canadian CVSA and the RCMP. They're all focused on our small community. That's all the elements of colonialism in its most extreme. What it would do for us specifically as Mohawks, it would enable our community to finally say there's no basis on which to have these band and tribal council systems on our community. It removes whatever rationale the states or the provinces have for imposing those systems on us, because doctrine does say that does give the Christian power specific powers, authority when it comes to jurisdiction on our and it has been cited. Probably the most blatant example was in 2005 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the doctrine applied to Iroquois territory, and that it gave the Christians the right to assume ultimate jurisdiction over our land. The odd thing about it is that opinion was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a Jewish woman whose ancestors were being kicked out of Spain at the exact same time in the same port as Cristobal Colon or Columbus was leaving to arrive on Turtle Island. And that was cited, and it has been replicated in Canadian judicial proceedings as well. So anybody that says that it was somehow qualified over the centuries is wrong. It's still a viable part of our judicial nightmare here in our Mohawk community. So what it really does is it has to return our territory, all 26 million acres, back to the status as being under the possession of indigenous people. And it will give us an opportunity finally to unite Akwesasne under one administration. That's what we think will happen. It'll put an end to those Supreme Court rulings and any claim the Supreme Court has over our peoples, the latest of which was announced in June when they said that the states had a right to enforce criminal law on non-natives on our territory. I mean, that's a disastrous ruling, and it's based on this doctrine, the assumption that they somehow, based on their Christian background, have supreme authority over Aboriginal people. This could revolutionize everything. It could change border crossing rights. It could affect trade and commerce and governance and culture as well. So if we can get them to do that, then that miracle will truly take hold in our communities.
Well, Doug George Conatillo, thank you so much. Yeah. It's good. I know you were only given a minute with the Pope when you turned that down. No. But here we explained it in, we still need more time, but we explained it in basically 25 minutes. But it's good to hear you again and honor you for being who you are and keeping that integrity going, that honesty, and because it is, after all, about the land. And thank you so much.
Okay, you can imagine what would have happened if I had gone to Quebec City and put a Mohawk headdress of Gastoa on top of
it. That's another thing we could talk about. But
yeah, I would be exiled from
sure. That's so funny. So, but hey, sure. Thank you, Doug. Sure. Thanks, man.
Okay.
We'll talk soon. Okay.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. I'm gonna go ahead.
saxophone. Through the walls, you hear the city go. Outside, it's America.
This song I just played, Bullet the Blue Sky. In 1985, Amnesty International brought along the band U2's Bono, where he stayed with a group of guerrillas in the mountains of the north country of El Salvador. And the song talks about foreign policy, especially pre-NAFTA, promoting unrest of indigenous peoples' original consciousness with Earth, which is not pledged to a flag of consumerism. NAFTA, being the North American Free Trade Agreement, which runs roughshod over anything indigenous and even past treaties for the safety and the security to flaunt capitalism and derision toward those who do not want destruction of Earth cultures protecting the lands. It's sad to hear but expectant that celebrities often sell out to the flame of fame and eventually the misfortune of egoism and anthropocentricity. And the main players in this game? Canada and the United States. I do this so that others may live, especially the earth, learn how to live with the earth and not take from the earth. This is Teokasin Ghost Horse. I am Teokasin Ghost Horse. Miama Lakota Teokasi. Thank you for joining us here on First Voices Radio.
Sing for me, I want.